Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all lines are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone if you would like to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn our meeting over to Ms. Loretta Jackson-Brown. Ms. Jackson-Brown, you may begin.
Thank you, Priscilla. Good afternoon. I'm Loretta Jackson-Brown, and I'm representing the Clinician Outreach and Communication Activity, COCA, with the Division of Strategic National Stockpile at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I'm delighted to welcome you to today's COCA call, Measles 2015, Situational Update, Clinical Guidance, and Vaccination Recommendations. We are pleased to have with us today Dr. Jane Seward from CDC. She will provide information on the current measles situation in the U.S. There is no continuing education provided for this call. The PowerPoint slide set and webinar link are available from our COCA webpage at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. At the conclusion of today's session, the participant will be able to describe the current measles situation in the United States, discuss the clinical presentation of measles and the clinical guidelines for patient assessment and management, identify CDC vaccination recommendations, and outline CDC measles resources available for clinicians. At the end of the presentation, you will have the opportunity to ask the presenter questions. On the phone, dialing star 1 will put you in the queue for questions. On the webinar, you can submit your questions by clicking on the Q&A tab at the top of the webinar toolbar. Today's presenter, Dr. Jane Seward, is the Deputy Director of the Division of Viral Diseases in the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases at CDC. She obtained her medical degree from the University of Western Australia, her clinical training in pediatrics and infectious disease at Tulane University, and her master's degree in public health and epidemiology from Emory University. Her public health career has spanned both domestic and international arenas in the fields of maternal and child health, birth defects, nutrition, and immunizations. Since 1996, Dr. Seward has worked at CDC in the field of immunizations. She is an internationally recognized expert in vaccine-preventable diseases, including measles, mumps, rubella, varicella, herpes zoster. At this time, please welcome Dr. Seward.
Good afternoon, and thanks for joining the measles update today. A reminder that at CDC, IZ Learn is live tweeting the event this afternoon. So we'll go right into the update. I'll start with, I'll be covering measles and the disease. Including complications. I'll then be talking about the global situation for measles, covering measles epidemiology in the United States over the time since the vaccine was introduced, then focusing on measles epidemiology since measles elimination, and then with a focus on the last 2 years, and then updating you on MMR vaccine recommendations and clinical guidance. So as you're all very well aware, I think, measles is a febrile rash illness caused by the measles virus. It's very highly transmissible, transmitted via respiratory droplets and aerosol, so it can be spread easily by coughing and sneezing, especially. If anybody is in a room, you're very likely to come down with measles if you're susceptible. It is contagious from 4 days before to 4 days after rash onset. With an R0 of 12 to 16, that means that in a susceptible population, you expect 12 to 16 cases for every case of measles. So one case can infect 12 to 16 secondary cases. In households, the secondary attack rate in susceptible household contacts is 90% or higher. Measles has a very distinct clinical course. It starts with a prodrome of fever, which can be very high, up to 105 or even higher degrees Fahrenheit. And then the hallmark in the prodrome are the three C's: cough, coryza, and conjunctivitis. Coryza is runny nose, and conjunctivitis is runny eyes or red eye, pink eye. And then if people know to look for this and know how to recognize, there can be a very characteristic enanthem or spots on the mucous membranes inside the mouth called coplic spots. Then the prodrome is followed by a rash or an exanthem about 14 days after exposure. That incubation period, though, can range from 7 to 21 days. The rash is macular, papular. It spreads from the head and trunk down to the extremities. In severe cases, can become confluent, and it lasts 5 to 6 days and fades in the order of appearance. Measles can have some very severe complications, which is why the vaccine got developed, especially in children under 5 and in adults. So quite commonly, it can cause diarrhea, otitis media. It can cause viral and bacterial complicated pneumonia. Encephalitis occurs at a rate of about 1 per 1,000 cases. And even now, in 2015, in developed countries, measles has a mortality of about 1 to 3 deaths per 1,000 cases. And then perhaps what not as well recognized is the late effect of measles in causing subacute sclerosing panencephalitis at a rate of 1 in 100,000 cases 7 to 10 years after the measles infection. And often that's hard to diagnose because people don't think about it with measles cases acquired, you know, a decade before. And that's usually fatal. The measles disease burden in the U.S. in the decade before the vaccine was licensed, we had 500,000 reported cases annually at that time, but there were 3 to 4 million estimated cases. Essentially, every person got measles during their lifetime. Of the 3 to 4 million cases, 48,000 were hospitalized. There were 4,000 encephalitis cases and 450 to 500 deaths on average every year. Most of those were in healthy children. On a global scale, measles was a huge cause of death and disability, estimated to cause 2.6 million deaths a year in 1980 at the start of the expanded program on immunizations due to a very accelerated program for measles control and elimination. There's been a 75% decrease in estimated deaths from 2000 to 2013. Nevertheless, there are still 400 deaths occurring a day around the world, just to give you an idea of the extent of measles mortality still. So measles does remain a leading cause of vaccine-preventable deaths in children less than 5. In those children, too, it can cause all the complications I discussed, including blindness, often complicated by vitamin A deficiency. There are still a lot of measles in the world, despite the tremendous advances in measles control and elimination. There are an estimated 20 million cases a year, and this is very relevant to us, as you'll find out later, in our post-elimination status in this country, because those cases come into the U.S. on a regular basis. So this slide shows measles, reported measles cases, which is a gross underestimation of the amount of cases that actually occur, but gives you an idea of the measles cases reported from the different WHO regions. So the Afro region, Southeast Asian region, American region, EMRO or Eastern Mediterranean region, European region in red, and the Western Pacific region in this brown color. And this shows you that, you know, over the years there's been a difference in where measles predominated around the globe. It has remained endemic in some countries, but there was a lot of measles in Europe back in 2010, 2011. We had a large number of importations of measles in 2011 into the U.S., and a lot of those were from Europe. You'll see over the last 12 months, there's been a huge number of reported cases from the Western Pacific region, and last year we saw 25 separate importations from the large outbreak in the Philippines. This slide is just to highlight a large outbreak that occurred in France over the years of 2000 and mainly 2010-11, but just to show you that there were very few cases being recorded in France in 2008, and then suddenly there was this huge outbreak. And so I think we need to be very cautious that we achieve and maintain our high coverage so that we don't get reestablished endemic disease transmission. France had more than 20,000 cases and 10 deaths over this time period. In the United States, the measles vaccine was licensed in 1963, and you see that there was a dramatic decline in cases after that, with some peaks again in the 1970s, late 70s, and then again around 1990, where we had large outbreaks of measles in inner city, large urban areas in the U.S. In 1989, we had the second dose recommended routinely for children, and in the year 2000, we had measles elimination declared in the U.S. This is the same data showed as an incidence slide, so just accounting for population changes in population numbers over time. And so you see that the number of cases we had in 2014 was well above the line that we like to see for measles elimination, a line of one case per million population. And this incidence rate was the highest incident rate we'd had since 1994. So measles was declared eliminated in the year 2000, and it was that status was achieved due to our very high two-dose vaccine coverage, our high-quality measles surveillance and response, and also to improve measles control in the WHO region of the Americas, meaning which resulted in us getting far fewer importations from countries that threatened to spread. And also to highlight that elimination does not mean gone forever. It just means that it's not endemically transmitted in this country year-round, but we can still get imported cases. We still expect to get imported cases every year, and we get limited spread from some of those cases. Just to highlight, this is a paper by somebody in our group, Amy Feibelkorn, published in 2010, that summarized the first 8 years after measles elimination in the U.S., showing that the highest incidence disease for measles was in the infants 6 to 11 months, and then in children 12 to 15 months. By far, they had the highest incidence, and almost a third of the infants, 6 to 11 months, were unvaccinated and traveled abroad. So these children should have been vaccinated in accordance with our recommendations, and almost half the 12 to 15-month-old cases were also unvaccinated and traveled abroad. So they didn't get their first dose, or they should have had two doses before they traveled. So just remember, you know, that sort of is in keeping with a higher susceptibility. Babies less than 6 months may have some protection from maternal antibody, so the greatest risks of susceptibility are in the age groups where we see the highest incidence. So this slide shows measles reported cases from 1966 to 2014. From 2001 on, we were able to break the cases into those that are importations and those that are not, in the yellow. So red imported cases, you know, have varied from year to year, and you'll see those summarized on the next few slides. You can notice that in the last few years, we've certainly seen a trend for an increased number of reported measles cases in this country, which is concerning. last year because of we did a Coca-Cola a year ago, and at that time put together, or soon after that, put together this infographic to remind people that measles can, when measles happens anywhere in the world, it can travel and spread to the United States. And so you need to be vaccinated before travel, but you can also acquire measles here if you get exposed to a traveler or to an outbreak in your community. So now I'll summarize measles epidemiology in the first 11 years, actually, following declaration of elimination. We had a median of 60 cases reported a year, with the range, as you see there. We had 33, so half of those cases, or a bit more than half, 33 a year, were importations. Most of those were not people that traveled here from overseas. They were our own residents who traveled abroad and weren't protected. So we can only blame ourselves for these importations. 25% of cases were hospitalized. We had 2 deaths in approximately 1,000 cases, so just in line with the risk that I quoted earlier. The incidence was less than 1 case per million, except in that year, every one of these years was less than one per million. Most of the cases were unvaccinated, 65%. 20% did not know their vaccination status, and 15% were vaccinated. Most that did not know their vaccination status were adults. So this is a call out to those adult providers to try to do your best to get adult vaccination records and get them in a registry if you have one. We had 4 outbreaks of measles a year, ranging from 2 in a small year to 12 outbreaks in a large year. The outbreaks were small, with a median number of cases of 6. So going on to the next 4 years, 2011 to 2014, we had a much higher number of cases reported, of 205. Or a mean of 277, and the number of importations and outbreaks is shown here. You can just read those, but we had more importations each year and a large number of outbreaks in 2011 and 2014. One of our very important tools for linking outbreaks or linking cases that occur is measles genotyping, and this is why it's very important for physicians to get viral specimens for both PCR testing or virus isolation if possible, but also for genotyping. And so this is a slide showing the distribution of measles genotypes over the last 12 months. Around the world, and not surprisingly, the U.S. gets lots of different genotypes because measles can come from lots of different places. So this slide shows cumulative number of measles cases by month of rash onset from 1997 to 2014, and you can see that again, this is just a different way of showing that the last few years, 2008, then 2013, 2011, and then 2014, very dramatically, had a lot more measles cases than previous years. And where are we for 2015? In the first month, we have far exceeded any of the years that are on this graph, which, as I said, is quite concerning. So just to summarize briefly, measles cases last year in 2014, these are provisional reports to CDC through the end of the year. That number may change before final publication in the MMWR. We had 644 cases reported from 27 states, and this included 23 outbreaks. We had 60 importations that we detected and a number that we missed, because we had imported virus cases, cases where we could identify a genotype but no known link to an importation. So among those 60 importations, 25 were from the Philippines, 9 were from India, and 91% of them were among U.S. residents.
almost all our cases were associated with known importations. We had quite a low rate of hospitalization last year, and this was mainly due to a very large outbreak among the Amish population in Ohio, where a smaller percentage of those cases were hospitalized. So considering cases in U.S. residents where we can check vaccination status more carefully, 77% were unvaccinated, 15% didn't know their vaccination status, and a minority were vaccinated. And among the unvaccinated, almost 80% were people that chose not to be vaccinated because of personal belief exemptions. 8% were too young to be vaccinated. So where did the measles importations come from? Well, all over the place, as you can see here. I've already mentioned the Philippines. You can see the Western Pacific region really on fire with measles last year. They had this huge outbreak in the Philippines. China's had a resurgence of measles. There was an outbreak in Vietnam and an outbreak that we assisted the Federated States of Micronesia with. But it came from Europe and other parts of the world, including India. So now to 2015, we've had a very large multi-state outbreak that started in California on December the 28th. And as of last week, since the 28th of December, 125 people from 7 states were reported to be part of this outbreak, linked to amusement parks in California. For the year as a whole, we've had 141 cases, and these dates start on January the 1st. So in addition to the 7 states that I mentioned before, we've had 10 additional states and Washington, D.C. that have had measles outbreaks this year. And most of these cases are part of that large multi-state outbreak, but a number are not. We've had 6 importations from a variety of different countries this year. Some other highlights, well, the 6 importations are shown here, the 6 countries. Most of the cases this year are unvaccinated, or a significant number, again, in adults, have unknown vaccination status. Our cases this year are, we have a lot of adult cases as well as children. And we've identified 3 different measles genotypes this year, B3, D8, and D9. Many of you may have also seen in the recent couple of weeks in the media this child care center outbreak in Illinois, where there are 9 confirmed measles cases in babies less than 12 months and 1 case in an adult. And that investigation is ongoing. This slide highlights the largest outbreaks that we've had since measles elimination was declared, the ones that have greater than 20 cases. And you can see that in recent years, since 2013, really we've had a real jump in some large outbreaks, with 58 cases and an outbreak in Brooklyn in 2013, 383 cases in the outbreak in Ohio last year, and this year to date, 125 from the outbreak that started last year. Just to mention that it's a huge amount of work for public health departments to do all the follow-up on these measles cases and contacts and offer vaccine and all the things that they have to do to trace every single person that's been in contact with a measles case to try to shut down these outbreaks. And so that's been documented in some publications that you see here. So now on to measles and MMR vaccines. We have live viral vaccines. As you know, the measles single vaccine was licensed in 1963, and our combination MMR vaccine was licensed in 1971. We don't have monovalent vaccines available anymore, and we also have a multivalent MMRV vaccine available since 2006. Measles vaccine has an excellent safety profile with 50-plus years of use. There is a low risk of febrile seizures in children. You can get temporary pain and stiffness in joints, particularly in teenage or adult women, and there's a known association with temporary low platelet count that can occur. This is one of our most effective vaccines, and so this is why you almost always see measles in unvaccinated people. Measles finds the unvaccinated susceptibles in the population. One dose is about 93% effective in preventing measles, and two doses is about 97%. So just to highlight the routine recommendations for two doses for children and adolescents at 12 to 15 months and 4 to 6 years, with catch-up vaccination as needed. Adults without evidence of measles immunity need two doses if they're in a high-risk group for exposure and transmission, which includes healthcare workers, post-high school students, and travelers. Other adults need one dose. And then there are specific travel recommendations. So anyone 12 months of age or older without evidence of immunity should receive two doses. So this includes providing an early second dose to children prior to 4 to 6 years and includes adults who have only received one routine dose in the past. Additionally, and this is an important recommendation that many physicians and pediatricians are not fully aware of, that children aged 6 to 11 months should receive one dose before they go abroad, and then they'll need that dose is not considered a valid dose. They'll need two other doses after 12 months. So just to highlight here that we have achieved and maintained reasonably high vaccine coverage among children at age 2 years or 19 to 35 months and among our teenage children with two doses. So 92% of our two-year-olds are vaccinated with one dose and about the same percent of adolescents. The other side of that is that 8 children out of 100 are not vaccinated on time with their first dose and are susceptible to measles. So that's at the national level. At the state level and at lower levels, you do get more granular data that can highlight some clustering of people that choose not to vaccinate. And this is a paper published in 2012. The data are now 3 years old. And so these rates have undoubtedly continued to climb, especially showing here that although exemption rates remain fairly low overall at 2% for the country, excluding the two states that don't allow any non-medical exemptions, these rates varied. They were much higher in states that allowed philosophical exemptions than states that had only religious exemptions. And then for states that allow exemptions, the exemption rate is much higher in states that have an easy exemption policy. That can mean just signing a form for the parent. That can be easier than going and getting the records, as opposed to states that have a difficult exemption policy. Where the rates were very similar, actually, to religious exemption-only rates. And so there has been some interest, I think, among in-states in looking at their policies, especially the ease or difficulty of getting these exemptions. So if measles it's very important to suspect measles and to diagnose it as quickly as possible because a rapid public health response can help prevent spread. We're aware that many U.S. healthcare providers have never seen a case of measles because of the success of our vaccination program. And because of that, they may not recognize a case, and delay in diagnosis can really contribute to transmission. So we urge providers to consider measles in the differential diagnosis of febrile rash illness. If you're thinking Kawasaki's, you should be thinking measles, especially if somebody's traveled abroad or have been in contact with somebody that's traveled abroad or hasn't is unvaccinated. So Kawasaki, scarlet fever, dengue. If somebody comes back from overseas, think measles before you think dengue, because that's much more common. Take a travel history. Take a history, if they haven't traveled, of exposure to somebody who's traveled, or ask if there's measles in the local community. And be especially suspicious in an unvaccinated person. This is not to say, though, that measles cannot occur in vaccinated people. It can. So don't discard the diagnosis if you've got what looks like measles in somebody who's vaccinated. Still do the testing, etc. So how do you confirm a measles case? I mean, you use your clinical judgment according to the, you know, the signs and symptoms that I mentioned earlier, but lab testing is available and is needed for confirmation. The serology testing for IgM, and then we highly encourage viral specimens as well to be tested for PCR and, as I mentioned, for genotyping. Acute and convalescent specimens for IgG may be useful, especially in vaccinated cases. So that first blood, you know, can be sent for IgM, can also be tested for IgG, and then if there's any query about the diagnosis, a convalescent sera can be obtained. A reminder that suspected measles cases are considered a public health emergency and should be reported immediately to the local health department. The state health department needs to report a measles case to CDC within 24 hours. So it's on the emergency list of reports to CDC that is put together by the Council for State and Territorial Epidemiologists. The other thing a health care provider should do is to offer vaccine or immune globulin immediately to household members. While they have them in the office, they should check their immunity and offer vaccine or immune globulin to those that don't have acceptable evidence of immunity. Acute measles cases that are severe, that is those that are hospitalized, should be treated with vitamin A. And we haven't been highlighting this in the past, so I'm highlighting it today. This will be going up on the healthcare provider webpage. I don't think it's there now, but it should be there by tomorrow if it's not. And this is in line with WHO guidance that's highlighted here at the bottom of the slide and the AAP Red Book. The online version is available now, the 2015 Red Book, and that text will be updated to exactly match this text. It's always been in the Red Book, but they're going to also add severe measles hospitalized cases. And so children get two doses of vitamin A on the day of admission and then on the next day, 24 hours later, and the recommended doses are listed here according to age. Public health response, I mentioned previously, cases must be isolated. They won't be seen until rash onset typically, so they should be isolated until 4 days after rash onset. As I mentioned, these cases have to be immediately notified to CDC by phone. We have to contact the CDC quarantine station if there's relevant travel. There's a lot of contact tracing to be done on planes and at airports. States typically alert physicians statewide and ask for enhanced measles surveillance throughout the state to look for additional cases. And then the huge amount of work that the state health department start immediately is contact investigation and response efforts. If you see measles in your clinic, an ER or hospital setting, isolate that case immediately. The case should be put in an airborne isolation room, or if you're in a hospital, or in a private room with the door closed if you're in a clinic, and you should mask the patient if that's feasible. You should ensure that the healthcare person dealing with that case has evidence of immunity, and in hospital settings, respiratory precautions, including N95 masks or PAPAs, are required, even for those with evidence of immunity. Contact investigations are done by the health department, and those are everybody exposed during the case's infectious period, and that includes exposures in areas 2 hours after the case left, and that's a lot of work in hospitals, but that's very, very high priority. the health department has to get records of vaccination or evidence of immunity for all those contacts, or draw blood to establish evidence of immunity if they can, or else just offer vaccine, which is often simpler. And then, depending on that evidence, they may quarantine contacts who don't have that evidence if those people choose not to be vaccinated or receive immune globulin, which are the two post-exposure prophylaxis options. This table is in the ACIP recommendations at the web link that's shown here. I won't go through it, but it's an excellent, very useful table that I highly recommend that you have taped to your wall to be able to check at any time who has evidence of immunity, what things are acceptable evidence of immunity. And I would point out that history of disease is no longer considered evidence of immunity. It was, but it was taken off the evidence table in 2013. So MMR vaccine is should be offered to exposed contacts without evidence of immunity within 72 hours of exposure. They may go back to normal activities, except if they're in a healthcare setting, but they should still be monitored for symptoms. Babies 6 to 11 months can be vaccinated, but be aware that there's a possibility of vaccine rash. And then immune globulin can be given out to 6 days following exposure. The recommended doses are here, and please note that these doses are different from the doses that were in the 1998 ACIP recommendations. So make sure that if health departments are listening in, that you have updated these recommendations on your website. Previously, the recommendation was for 0.25 mLs per kilogram for IgIM and for 100 milligrams per kilogram of IV. So these are higher, and that's because immune globulin now is mainly manufactured from people with vaccine-induced evidence of immunity and not disease-induced. And so please take note of these changes. And so the recommended immune globulin is recommended for people who can't be vaccinated. So you can give it to infants less than 12 months. So 6 to 11-month-olds can get either immune globulin or vaccine. Pregnant women should get this, and they have to get IVIG. It's a large dose, and also severely immunocompromised patients. So just to summarize, measles in the post-elimination era is due to failure to vaccinate. Measles elimination is a global problem. We should expect to see importations continuing, despite tremendous advances in global measles control and elimination. There's still a lot of measles around the world, and a lot of people travel, and measles is just a plane ride away. So measles occurs in the U.S. every year. We should expect it to occur in the U.S. every year. It's eliminated, but it's not gone. Maintenance of elimination is a lot of work and effort. It takes smart, thoughtful healthcare providers to recognize a case. So we rely on you all in your offices to recognize these cases, to think measles if you see a rash with fever in someone who's traveled, to do your best to vaccinate all your patients, and to be providing as much information as you can to parents who may have concerns about vaccination. And then, offer measles, maintaining elimination does need advanced laboratory techniques, which we can offer here at CDC as well as at some state health departments. And we have updated a lot of materials on our website. So we have updated outbreak and case information available. They're updated weekly now at the website shown here with a map showing the measles cases that are linked to the California amusement park outbreak. We have updated resources for healthcare professionals, shown at this website here. Some more updated materials for healthcare providers, a NET conference, Medscape video, children with measles video for those of you that have never seen a case. More information and resources for healthcare providers, banners, fact sheets, information to use to have discussions with parents and patients about measles. So some of those are just great tools for you to use. And then finally, resources for parents and caregivers. We've got a great new infographic that you can see here. Measles isn't just a little rash. We've got some other great materials that you can look at, including materials in Spanish. And I'd like to acknowledge a lot of people out there in the state and local health departments who are doing all the boots on the ground work, and all the staff at CDC here that have helped. Thank you. And with that, I'll take questions.
Thank you, Dr. Seward, for providing our COCA audience with such a wealth of information. We do understand that some of today's participants have experienced technical difficulty when attempting to access the audio portion of today's webinar. Please note that the recorded webinar, along with the transcript and an audio, will be posted to the COCA call webpage for today's call. In addition, the PowerPoint slides are currently posted, and the website is emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. We will now open up the lines for the question and answer session. Joining us for the question and answer portion of today's call are Sarah Foster and Allison Fisher with CDC. Operator, we are ready for the first question.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your touch-tone phone. Please unmute your phone and record your first and last name, as this information is needed to introduce your question. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your touch-tone phone. If you wish to withdraw your question, please press star 2. One moment for our first question.
And while we're waiting for the operator, we'll go ahead and take a question through the webinar system. Dr. Seward, do you foresee that CDC will recommend that children 6 to 11 months in age in outbreak settings in the U.S. get vaccinated with one dose of MMR?
Yes, that's an excellent question. And CDC does recommend in specific outbreak settings where there's ongoing community transmission affecting that age group with ongoing risk of exposure. So children, babies 6 to 11 months have to be measles cases in an ongoing way to make that recommendation. And so we have not seen epidemiology in the outbreaks this year that would indicate that that recommendation is needed. That recommendation is typically made at the local level where they understand and the local epidemiology. So, for example, the outbreak in the child care center in Illinois, that affected one child care center. So it was very bad for those babies. All the babies who could have had IG would have been given it, but I don't think they knew in time to get that. But other babies exposed in the at emergency rooms, et cetera, were offered immune globulin. But there was no ongoing transmission in that age group, and so that even that was not a cause to recommend that early dose. So you really need ongoing outbreak with ongoing transmission affecting that age group. And that recommendation is a recommendation in the ACIP guidance, and so physicians can look at that and health departments can look at that in the 2013 ACIP recommendations and the wording that clarifies. It's not, there are pluses and minuses to giving that early dose. You know, you can affect the immune response to a later dose, and so you don't do it lightly.
Thank you. Operator, do we have a question on the phone?
Our first question is from Allison. Allison, your line is open.
Hi, this is Allison Hagwood from the South Carolina State Health Department. What are the PPE recommendations for ambulatory providers that do not have access to the fitted N95 mask, and are there any alternative options regarding PPE?
Well, if you don't have access to N95, the best thing you can do is just mask mask yourself and the patient, if possible, if the patient is able to tolerate a mask, and close the door.
Okay.
And avoid people coming into the room who don't have evidence of immunity or a mask on.
Okay. Thank you.
Our next question is from Diane. Your line is open.
Yes. Hi there. This is Diane Higgins calling from a rural area in western Nevada. Of the percentage of children in that recent Disneyland outbreak, what percent roughly had already been vaccinated against measles?
I don't have the breakdown for the children. I have the breakdown overall for the for the multi-state outbreak. So 13% of cases in that outbreak are vaccinated. 12% are vaccinated.
Okay, so only 12% have been vaccinated.
Yeah, and that's not a concerning number because most people in the population are vaccinated. And so if you sort of do the math of, say, 1,000 people in the population and maybe 900 of them are vaccinated and they may have a 3% failure rate, and that'll add up to 27 people getting measles, and 100 people are unvaccinated and 90% of them will get measles if they're exposed, you're going to have 90 unvaccinated cases and 27 vaccinated cases. So about a quarter of your cases in that case will be vaccinated. So it's a function of high vaccine coverage and a low failure rate that gets us that proportion vaccinated.
All right. And may I ask one more question? After placement of a purified protein derivative tuberculosis skin test, what's the wait period for giving the MMR? Our public health, our county public health people have given us different answers. One said they can be given simultaneously. The other one says they have to wait for a week after they have the PPD to get their MMR vaccine. What's the verdict on that, please?
I'll need to get back with you on that. I don't have that at the tip of my tongue. Maybe I do. Okay. So, MMR vaccine might interfere with the TB skin test, and so if it is to be performed, it should be given either any time before the vaccine, simultaneously with,
mm-hmm.
or at least 4 to 6 weeks after.
I get it.
Yeah.
So the PPD could be placed at 10 in the morning with the MMR being given at 2 in the afternoon.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for giving such an informative conference. We appreciate it.
Thank you for listening in.
All right. Bye-bye.
Mike, your line is now open.
Jane, can you comment on the utility and what types of serology you can use, because this is obviously the alternative to immunizing people, if in doubt.
Sorry, I don't quite understand the question.
What specific serologic tests are readily available without long time delay? Because that's the alternative to, when in doubt, immunizing if you can.
Oh, correct. If you don't know evidence of immunity. So if you have, people exposed to a case and you don't have a vaccination record, so evidence of immunity can be age-appropriate vaccination. So if you've got a record, they're fine. If you don't have a record, then if they're born before 1957, they're fine. We're considered to be immune. So you don't need anything for them. And then others, you can do a serological test if you are confident that you'll get the result quickly and that person will come back into your office for the result. And it's a commercially available IgG test. If there's any question about whether the patient will come back, then it's often easier. It might be more expensive to do a test and then have another office visit than just to give an extra MMR vaccine dose.
Yes.
It's safe to give an extra dose, and it may just be easier.
comment, and it also has the advantage of providing a boost in immunity to mumps.
Absolutely. Good point.
Our next question is from Sarah. Your line is open.
Yes, you kind of just answered this a little bit, but I just want to make sure, because we were under the assumption that with this outbreak situation, when you have a patient, even somebody who was born before 1957, if they did not have immunity, evidence of immunity, whether that would be the the blood draw for that, or having documented two doses, because of the 70-year-old patient who was infected, that we were still supposed to give them one booster. Is that not the case?
It's only healthcare workers that we worry about, that we do not accept evidence birth before 1957 as evidence of immunity when exposed.
Okay.
So, you know, very occasionally you'll get a case in somebody who's older, but it's not very often. And in healthcare workers, we just don't want to take any risk whatsoever.
Okay, so that's the only case is the healthcare workers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
And Dr. Siebert, before we go on to the next question, can we stay on healthcare workers for a bit? We have quite a number of questions in the webinar related to that same particular topic. So, some of the participants want to know a little bit more detail about what they need to do with their healthcare workers if they've already vaccinated them, they're not showing signs of immunity. Do they need to go ahead and give a third dose of MMWR? And also that lack of documentation, and if they have a negative rubeola titer with two documented MMWRs, will that trump the titer? So they have some ongoing questions about what to do with healthcare workers and when they're able to actually come back to work and what's considered immunized.
Right. Okay, so we do get this question quite a lot. Firstly, it's very important to document your status of all your workers before you have a situation of exposure, because it's very difficult to go running around and find all the records, especially if you don't have electronic records, once you have an exposure in a healthcare setting. So it saves you a lot of time and money to be well prepared for that and have documented, easy to obtain, either electronically or in any other fashion, records. For healthcare personnel, documentation of vaccination is two doses of live measles virus-containing vaccines or laboratory evidence of immunity, a serological test showing evidence of immunity in the past, or rarely lab confirmation of disease. That's not common, but if a healthcare worker happened to have measles disease and had it confirmed by PCR 2 years ago, that would count, right? And then birth before 1957, except in an outbreak setting. And so once you've got measles in your facility, if they have any of those things, the birth before 1957 doesn't count anymore, and so you've got to go and test people who were born before 1957. And that's why we recommend being proactive and actually knowing the evidence of immunity for those people, whether they have serologic evidence or not, so that you don't have to do it during an outbreak. Two doses trump serology, and so there's no need to test after getting vaccinated. If you have any positive test in the past, that counts for now. If you go and test now, you don't need to test now. But if it's negative, you actually can rely on the two doses in the past, according to our formal recommendations. There's no recommendation for an extra dose for people who are seronegative.
Thank you. Hopefully that helped to answer a lot of questions for today's participant. Operator, we have any more questions on the phone?
We have several questions. Liz, your line is open.
Yes, hi, good afternoon. My question is regarding an outpatient setting. If we have a patient that the physician suspects has measles, they collect the specimen and the patient is discharged home, what will be given, the instructions given to the patient, what type of isolation, how will we manage those patients at that point? And what type of
you should call your local health department. They're the ones that will manage them from that point. So you tell your local health department, before that patient leaves the office, you should call the health department and say, I have a suspected measles case. I've drawn the blood. I've sent it to this lab. And so they will work with you from that point on. And they would, you know, if it's highly suspicious, in, especially if the person is unvaccinated and traveled abroad, the health department will consider that a measles case as far as starting contact tracing immediately. They won't wait for the lab result.
Okay.
And so they'll tell the patient.
We don't need to transfer that patient to the hospital at that point. They will give us further instructions.
Yeah, you don't need to put in the hospital unless they need to be put in the hospital for medical reasons. You'll hand you'll let the local health department know, and they will work with you closely. They'll take over the telling the patient what to do as far as isolation, and they'll talk to the patient to track the contacts. And so the patient only needs to talk to you about their medical condition.
Okay, thank you.
Kimberly, your line is now open.
Yeah, so in I was just wondering, in a healthcare facility and a measles patient were to present, if there's any, should be any consideration to the air circulation through the ventilation systems, if that's any risk to exposure?
Absolutely. So you need to talk to your engineers in the facility, and they'll tell you where that air, you know, how widely that air might have circulated, and any place that it has circulated in the last 2 hours is at risk for exposure.
Okay, so like in the clinic setting that you had mentioned and you shut the door, you really should be evaluating also those air circulation.
Yes.
Of where that might be. Thank you.
I was thinking clinic by outpatient, sort of private clinic. For that. In a hospital, if it's a clinic, yes, you should be talking to your, you would have a air isolation room, I would imagine, in that kind of setting.
Right. I would see if they were, you know, if they come into the ER in that situation before we got them there.
Right. It's a lot of work in a hospital. It's a lot of work. I mean, the priority for contact tracing is, you know, who's the most likely to be truly exposed. Right, have a very high chance of being sick if they come in contact with a case. And it's the people in the household, and it's that you worry about people in healthcare settings because you've got children under one in doctor's offices, you've got leukemic and cancer children in pediatric hospitals who can't be vaccinated, and that's the priority for contact tracing, those two groups right there.
And we've had a lot of discussions, too, in our clinic setting, especially where there's, you know, for pediatrics and so on as well.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yes, no, it's a lot of work. I mean, we've had, you know, we have many anecdotes of children being infected in doctor's offices.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Seward, can you, while we're on again, hospital settings or healthcare settings, can you reemphasize some of the points you made earlier in the slide to clarify? We got questions about that in general. When do healthcare workers need to put on an N95 or a PAPR? When do we need to identify those healthcare workers who are immunized? That versus a hospital setting versus any other type of healthcare setting. There's confusion about clinics, doctor offices, and what they need to do.
Well, the recommendation is an N95 mask or PAPR. We realize that that's unlikely to be available in a private doctor's setting. But in any hospital where those are available, they should be used the minute you suspect a measles case. So you may not suspect a case until you walk into the room, examine the case, and here's a child sitting with a high fever, a maculopapular rash, cough, coryza, conjunctivitis, and they traveled to the Philippines 2 weeks ago. So you should go on high alert if you see that kind of patient. You should walk out of the room get on an N95 mask or a PAPR before you go back in, notify the person in the clinic or in the emergency room that you've got a suspected measles case, and so everybody who goes into the room should be appropriately protected and ideally also have evidence of immunity, be appropriately vaccinated, which they should be anyway. But in addition, it's recommended because measles vaccine is not 100% effective. It's very effective, but not 100%. And there's a, healthcare workers are at risk of exposing people who could get seriously ill with measles, compromised patients. And that's the reason we have such high, standards of infection control in addition for healthcare workers. In a private clinic, if you're in a doctor's office and you've got five exam rooms, if somebody walks into your waiting room, the nurse should be trying to triage people that look acutely sick, and getting them into a waiting room and not having them sit in a general waiting room is for very long. But if somebody has a febrile rash illness, they should be, again, taken out of the general waiting room as soon as possible and put in a room with the door closed. And in a doctor's office, do whatever you can, put on a mask, get the patient out of the general waiting room, and advise your patients, especially unvaccinated patients. If you've got people that refuse vaccines, they should be told, if they travel and come back with a febrile rash, they need to call you, not just show up. They should call you and warn you that they'll be coming in, and you should try to see them at the beginning of the day or the end of the day, bring them in a different entrance, do whatever you can to minimize exposure to other people in your waiting room.
Thank you. Operator, do we have more questions on the phone?
We do. Shigar, your line is now open.
Hi, what if someone was born before 1957 and wants to travel? Do we still give the vaccine to the patient or not?
No, you don't need to be vaccinated if you were born before 1957.
And okay, Dr. Siewert, talk about that in a little bit more detail. You have about four questions on the webinar system, and folks are still a little confused about why 1957?
Okay. Yes. Well, so measles is a very highly infectious disease. And so before the vaccine was used, most children got measles before they were 10. Many got it before they were 5. So there were hardly any adults who were susceptible. And so the measles vaccine was licensed in 1963, but it didn't really start to get used in to a great extent for a few more years than that. And so basically they went back to birth 6 years before the vaccine program started, or about 10 years before the vaccine got used to any large extent, and figured that anybody born before that had already had measles before the vaccine was used widely in the country and were already immune. And then later serological studies verified that, showing that more than 95% of those people were immune. And so those people, we consider them immune. They don't need to be vaccinated. If they're a healthcare worker, we do have additional recommendations we say in our ACIP recommendations, for unvaccinated personnel born before 1957 who lack lab evidence of immunity for measles, mumps, or rubella, healthcare facilities should consider vaccinating people at the appropriate interval. And that's because in an outbreak, you'll have to vaccinate them. So it may be easier to do it before an exposure occurs. You don't have to. That's why it says you should consider. But in an outbreak, it's recommended. And so if you weigh up, is it easier to just hope you won't get exposed in your facility for those people, or is it easier to have on record whether they've got lab evidence, serologic evidence of immunity?
Thank you. Hopefully that helped a lot of our listeners today. Operator, do we have another question on the phone?
Cindy, your line is now open.
Hi. My question is, do you know what percent of the population needs to be immunized to have herd immunity when it comes to measles? We're trying to look at that in our community here in Waukesha, Wisconsin.
Yes, you need a population immunity level of, you know, a 92% to 94% to interrupt transmission in the community, and that requires 95% or more of all your children and adolescents, at least, having two doses of MMR vaccine. So you need very high coverage in the community to interrupt transmission. That needs to be in every community. And so if you have, you know, if you have a state coverage of 95%, but in a local county or, you know, some schools, it's much lower than that, those schools are not going to be protected if measles comes in there. The community, the herd can't protect them.
Thank you very much. That was just the answer we wanted.
Okay.
Ellen, your line is now open.
Yes, I'm the state epidemiologist in Utah, and we had a couple of these cases, and we're looking at our philosophical exemption rule and whether we should make it more difficult or actually get rid of philosophical exemptions, and wondered if other states have tried to do that, what are the consequences of trying to do that are.
Well, we could put you in touch with some other states that have done that. I mean, California actually made an effort to tighten up their philosophical exemption, and some other states are considering it right now. And, you know, different ways they've done it are things like requiring a notarized statement that you've read, you know, educational information, that you're informed about the seriousness of measles disease and the, you know, safety and effectiveness of MMR vaccine. Some states require, you know, watching a video and signing that you realize that, you know, you're putting other people at risk in the community. You know, there are lots of different approaches that states have taken. So we'd be happy to put you in touch with some particular states if you'd like. If you could just send, I know I've got your email address, so I can we can follow up with you after the call.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Michelle. Your line is open.
Thank you. Should adults in their 30s who were vaccinated once with the MMR at 15 months of age receive a second dose of the MMR?
Not unless they're in a high-risk group. So the high-risk groups in adults for who have a greater risk of being exposed or having serious consequences if they become a case are healthcare workers, students in post-high school educational facilities, and international travelers.
Thank
Other
you.
Adults just need one dose.
That exactly answers my question. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Jean, your line is open.
Hi. I was going to ask a question in regards to a quote from the CDC where it has people without evidence of immunity have been exempted from measles vaccination for medical, religious, or other reasons, and who did not receive appropriate PEP within the appropriate time frame should be excluded from affected institutions in the outbreak area until 21 days after the onset of rash and last case of measles. So having heard that, the recommendations, would that be if you just had one case of measles and you have a healthcare worker that's just in the building, but they we haven't confirmed their immune status, that they would have to be off work for 21 days, or if we have confirmed their immune status and they refused the vaccine because of medical or religious reasons, we would have to keep them off work from 21 days, no matter where they work in the institution?
Yes, that's correct. And if you want details, the ACIP recommendations for healthcare workers is online at on the CDC ACIP website. It summarizes all those recommendations in quite a lot of detail.
And just to tag on to that, we have a paper record, so we're going to be going through the process of, like, prioritizing the areas to first go in and do titers if we don't have documentation of the vaccine status. Has there been anything written about any work restrictions or safe places to put these employees if you don't have their immune status to go through this process? Like, for example, to exclude them from patient care?
I mean, those decisions can be made at the local level. I mean, we defer to local state health departments and hospitals to make those tough decisions. I mean,
okay.
We don't go into that level of detail. I think if people are excluded from patient care, that would seem reasonable, a reasonable compromise, if you're sure they are. But we don't go into that level of detail, I don't think, in the healthcare worker recommendations.
Okay, thank you very much.
Jeff, your line is now open.
Okay, so this question is concerning just adults in the general population, not healthcare or other high-risk persons. The summary of recommendations for adult immunization state that for adults born in after 1957, that they should receive at least one dose of MMR if they have no laboratory evidence of immunity.
All right.
But if a patient, an adult patient, states they've had measles, mumps, and rubella, but they don't have laboratory evidence, should
that's
they
not,
be vaccinated?
That's
because...
Not, oh, sorry. I apologize. Why don't you finish?
Okay, so it's an important question for health departments because, they operate under standing orders, and they have to interpret this. And should they take that literally and say, well, if you don't have the laboratory evidence, we you're indicated for a dose of MMR, even though they have, in their minds at least, reliable history of all three diseases?
Reliable history of all three diseases no longer counts as evidence of immunity for us per the 2013 MMR vaccine recommendations, the table on page 19 in those recommendations. That was removed from the evidence of immunity guidance because physicians don't remember what measles looks like now. Over the last 20, 30 years, there's been so few cases. And we don't necessarily trust. We heard a lot of anecdotal stories about healthcare workers in particular saying, oh, I had it when I was a child. And you just can't be wrong with healthcare workers. We need a very high level of evidence for immunity for healthcare workers. And so disease no longer counts as evidence of immunity.
No, okay, so but...
Neither for the general population either. Neither.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sue, your line is now open. Grace, your line is now open.
Good afternoon. We were wondering if in the vaccinated adults that you've seen in this most recent outbreak, if their clinical presentation is attenuated at all or if it's a classical presentation?
Yes, that's a great question. I don't know the details in this particular outbreak, but over the last, decade, we have seen vaccine-modified measles in vaccinated persons. Not always. But it can be modified, and I think it could be missed if you're not in an outbreak setting. So it can be a much more transient rash. The rash may not last for 3 days, which is part of the WHO case definition for measles. The fever may not be as high, and they may not have all the three C's. So high index of suspicion for vaccinated people. If they're exposed to a case.
Thank you. On behalf of COCA, I would like to thank everyone for joining us today with a special thank you to Dr. Siewert. We invite you to communicate to our presenter after the call. If you have questions for today's presenter, please email us at coca@cdc.gov. Put February 19th COCA call in the subject line of your email, and we will ensure that your question is forwarded for a response. Again, that email address is coca@cdc.gov. The recording of this call and the transcript will be posted to the COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA within the next week. There were no continuing education credits for this call. Resources for clinicians related to measles are available on the COCA call webpage. Go to emergency.cdc.gov/COCA, click COCA calls, and then follow the link for today's call. To receive information on upcoming COCA calls, you can subscribe to COCA by sending us an email at coca@cdc.gov and write subscribe in the subject line. Also, CDC launched a Facebook page for health partners. Like our page at facebook.com/CDC Health Partners Outreach to receive COCA updates. Thank you again for being a part of today's COCA call. Have a great day.
Thank you for joining. This concludes the conference call. All parties may disconnect at this time. Ms. Jackson-Brown? Ms. Jackson-Brown?
thank you for calling the Digital Replay Service.